Well, look at this. We have the knowledgeable guy and the somewhat goofy guy, but together on a good topic. Thanks for having me on the show, Paul. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on, Mike. And I'm really looking forward. You know, this has been a topic I've been wanting to do for a while. You know, one of the pillars of the network. And as things have been changing over the last couple of months, you know, we've basically seen, you know, June, we were kind of rising towards 2% of the GDP for our military spending.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, next thing you know, we go to NATO and lo and behold, we're at 5%. So I want to dig into it. And I want to have a good discussion today. So I'm looking forward to it.
It feels to me like we've suddenly had to make a reactionary jump to a new position with our military. And it does make me wonder if we're even poised to begin that process. So joining us today, Charlotte Duvall-Antoine, the VP of Operations for the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. Thanks so much for joining us, Charlotte.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, this is something I'm sure that you have had eyes on for some time. What is the Institute's first reaction to this kind of news coming out and that we are going to have this kind of increase in spending? What was your reaction as an institute?
So the Canadian Global Affairs Institute doesn't necessarily take a big policy stance because we're represented by a lot of different people with different opinions, but I will give you my own. While there needs to be some reservation about our ability to implement increased defense spending, as you've mentioned, I do think that this is something positive for Canada that we need to have a conversation about because there are a lot of implications for that increased defense spending that requires Canadians' attention. And thank you very much for bringing me on to have this conversation.
Delighted, because it is an important conversation. This is a lot of money. This is a big amount of spending.
Oh, crazy.
And, you know, it feels to me, and Paul, maybe you have a different opinion, but it feels to me that the military has been in somewhat disarray or a little bit of a neglect over several governments now. And now we're about to apply all of this money and hopefully a plan. It seems like it makes me wonder if we're prepared to do that.
Yeah. You know, so we're you know, just to put it in context, I'm sure Charlotte knows this really well, but you know, we spend roughly $30 billion a year is what our defense spending is.
How does that compare to the U.S., do you know?
The U.S. is like a trillion.
Okay.
You know, it's $917 billion, you know. And I always laugh, you know, we use these Bs. You know, it's funny, I was talking to you last night, you know, we're throwing around Bs, you know, B, B, B. You know, and quite frankly, but we were prepared. I guess when we hit the election, we were kind of prepared. Everyone kind of got in their head. We're going to go to 2%, right? You know, we were at 1.4 of GDP. You know, our GDP roughly is about 3 trillion. So for those of you who, you know, don't follow GDP, but 3 trillion is our GDP. So we're going to go to, you know, 2%, which is, you know, a big nut.
Yeah.
For us, right? So we kind of laid out a plan, and I think we were kind of going down that process. And we had a number of components. We were going to re-up some equipment. We were going to increase the human resource aspect of it, hire, you know, 29,000 more people. It was a big endeavor at two, right? And so now, you know, we're going to do that leap. We're saying, you know, we go to NATO, have this conversation. You know, I don't know. Charlotte, are you? I don't know if the guests will really understand NATO. You want to talk about NATO for a minute, or do you want me to jump in on it?
No, I can do that. So NATO is a military and political organization that was created in 1949. It's an alliance composed of now 32 members, which includes Canada and most of the European Union, Turkey, and the United States. And the goal of that alliance is what we call collective defense. So one of the pillars of NATO is an attack on one is an attack on all. And with that collective defense commitment, there are implications in terms of capability and spending, as you've been mentioning, Paul. At the latest NATO summit all the members agree to reaching 5% of defense spending of GDP spending. There are little nuances to that conversation around what that spending means and what it is, but NATO as an alliance committed to that amount of spending, which means that Canada in a way has committed to that kind of spending.
So now this is a bunch of spending that feels reactionary, not just to NATO, but to Trump's tariff threats. And I think that we actually seem to have made an agreement about our military before anything else has occurred in the way of a deal, which is a little unusual. But really, let's peel it back even one more step before that. You know, in your opinion, and please, if I've gotten your your representation of this wrong, our military was already in need of a pretty major overhaul from a cultural standpoint. Youth interest in signing up and getting involved in the military. There was a lot of issues already. Are we ready to take on a bunch of new money, a bunch of new responsibility, infrastructure, when some very basic things seemed to be already broken?
I would say it's not either or. And that's the issue. So our military, since Louis Saint Laurent essentially, has been going through booms and busts in terms of investment and attention paid by our politicians. And so because of that, and especially as a historian of the 1990s, essentially, we're reckoning with the budget cuts of the 1990s, and then after that, like limited rise in defense spending, then additional cuts under Harper. And sometimes defense cuts and personnel cuts lead to cultural issues. And so right now, as our military needs to modernize, because, for example, the ships that we're currently operating were purchased in the 1990s, so they're past their life cycle, so they need to win new ones. Their attention that lead to that in terms of, like, we don't have necessarily the resources to spend that money properly. We do not have the resources to be operational ready and all those difficulties. And culture is kind of what binds all of that. And what I would argue, and I wrote a paper about this in 2023, if we're looking at sexual misconduct or other conduct issues, they're often part of a symptom of a larger cultural issue within the Canadian military, which is impacting procurement and operational effectiveness. So there are a lot of layers to this, and I think that money can help fix the problem. But the thing is that the money is not just the silver bullet that's going to fix the problem. It's not throwing spaghetti at the wall and hoping it sticks, right? That money needs to come with structural changes that are necessary, one, to be able to spend that money more and faster and more effectively, but also to make sure that the resources within the Canadian military are properly distributed and encourage a culture of basically professionalism, if we can put it in a way that everyone can understand.
Well, you know, that's a good recap, because I think the 90s was that's when we started to get the feel that we were going to abandon our military a little bit here in Canada, that the spending was never coming back. What are your thoughts?
Well, two things. You know, it's interesting. I want to just 2 points. And the one is NATO and the recent meetings and the 5%, right? And the 5%. I really want to understand, did we put conditions on that at all? So, you know, we get these broad statements and it's like, okay, we're all going to commit to 5%, right? Well, you know, in this economic climate, which is your point, I think, Mike, you know, we're going to potentially be hit with tariffs. You know, we're going to know tomorrow or the next few days, you know, what the tariff situation is in Canada. You know, did we commit to 5% and not put conditions on that money? First of all, that's what I'd like to know, because I know if I'm doing a deal, if I'm buying real estate, or if I'm doing something big in my life, I put conditions on it to protect myself against the downside. And I think, as you know, as Canadians, we tend to not do that. And I know other countries do. You know, you know, the Ukraine, for example. You know, quite frankly, it's been a good topic with respect to conditions, because the U.S. under Trump has now put a bunch of conditions on their funding of the Ukraine, right? So another topic for another day. But it just shows that how countries, you know, whether they're funding developing countries or non-developed countries, always put conditions on money they're going to spend. So that's kind of the first thing I'd like to.
Yeah, that's a great question. Did we commit too quickly to military spending that we haven't got a recourse on?
So it's a little bit more complicated because the first time Canada committed to 2% of GDP in defense spending, it was in 2014. And it is only in June of 2025 that we had our government say we will reach 2% of GDP by the end of the fiscal year, so March 2026. And then it was at the previous NATO summit in 2024 that Justin Trudeau said that Canada will finally spend 2% of GDP in defense spending. So while we signed a communique at NATO in The Hague this past June, it doesn't mean that Canada will immediately spend those 5% of GDP. Canada still has the right to make this decision of whether or not they're going to do so. And I will give you the example of Spain. Spain has signed the communique, has said, okay, we will agree to those, to that 5% of GDP in defense spending. But they have also made it clear that this is not going to happen in the years to come. They're quite against increasing defense spending that much, but they needed a win at the NATO summit. And this is where politics come into this. And I think that the Trump element is important. Trump has been bullying, let's be real, the West, the rest of the West, in even non-NATO countries such as Australia, to increase the defense spending. The United States has taken an angle that security has become a condition for any other deals to happen. And because of that, we find ourselves hard-pressed to make a decision on whether or not we want to go to that direction. But I would like to shift a little bit the language around defense spending and the discourse around defense spending to give you another perspective. If all NATO members end up spending 5% of GDP in defense spending, and I want to clarify, it's 3.5% of GDP in direct defense spending and 1.5% in defense-related spending. And that involves infrastructure, roads, and ports, for example. That will lower the United States' influence on us and on our politics. So in one way, we're like, are we bending the knee to Trump and giving him what he wants? Or are we also giving ourselves strategic autonomy to then, if we get bullied by the United States down the line, we can tell them, back off. Now we do not need to rely on you for our own defense. So it's a fine line. It's a complicated position in which to find ourselves. You can disagree with it or not. You can find that it's a convenient way of framing the issue. But as someone that was born and raised in France and has been in Canada for the past decade and a bit, this is something that our former President General de Gaulle has advocated for: strategic autonomy from the United States in terms of defense. And maybe this is a path that we need to go to. Do we need to spend as much on defense to get there? Honestly, I don't know. And I think that that's a good question to ask ourselves. But let's not just think that we need to spend the money and then all of our problems will go away. There's a lot of nuance in that conversation.
Well, it actually sounds like global banking, for Pete's sake. It sounds like a lot of it is in the ether. We're making a commitment, but it doesn't really mean a commitment. It kind of actually pulls into question the value of NATO, to be honest with you, if all we're doing is exchanging memos. Am I off base here?
No, you're not. And it's interesting in the way it's communicated to the general population. It's great. I'm happy about that. I'm happy that.
Yeah.
We have an ability to determine outside of NATO what we're going to do on defense spending.
By the way, was the first time that's ever been explained to me in that way.
That's
so
perfect.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Charlotte. But yeah, it does kind of make me it does reposition NATO in my mind, to be honest with you.
Yeah. And it honestly makes it, I hate to say it, a little less relevant.
Yeah.
Given, you know, quite frankly, they're not committing to anything, right? So,
and can I ask you another quick question? And maybe Charlotte, yeah. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but if what we're trying to do is create a bit of autonomy from the U.S. in case we're bullied, we've got a long way to go. That $1 trillion or whatever it is a year up against our $750,000 a year or whatever it is comparatively, we'd have to go a long way, and NATO would have to step in that scenario as well.
Well, you know, and Charlotte actually had a good point. So, which I'm glad she explained NATO, you know, and this is an interesting thing, you know, years ago I figured out, you know, 32 countries, right? None of those countries, there's only us in the US and North America, right? Yeah. So Mexico, not in the play, right? And for a lot of reasons, politically, as Charlotte alluded to. So, you know, we are kind of the small cousin in the North America scene, and the others basically form primarily under EU. And there's been a lot of conversations prior to that NATO meeting at 5% between us forming an alliance, a multinational alliance with the EU on defense, right? So Charlotte's point, like we had kind of started down that road before the 5% discussion, having a discussion about forming with the EU, and the EU has a whole plan on what they want to do on defense. So I'm happy to know that. I'm not sure, quite frankly, it's a very awkward position, which Charlotte could probably talk to better than I can. But the fact that we're so closely aligned and geographically beside the US, you know, we are kind of committed to that strategy in a, we're pulled in, right?
Yeah.
Now the question, you know, that I know the Iron Dome and all those discussions about what we're going to get pulled into is still spiraling around.
Excuse me, it's called the Golden Dome. Oh, it was named after my head, actually.
Yeah, sorry. But, you know, those are the things that, you know, Trump is kind of, you know, he's got them in the atmosphere saying, you know, Canada, you can get in for free if you, you know, become the 51st state.
Yeah, what about that deal, Charlotte? Should we be taking that deal? Is that a better arrangement?
Listen, I immigrated to Canada and not the United States for a reason. So no, please, no. But could I add a couple nuances to what you were saying? So in terms of the relevance of NATO, NATO politically and NATO militarily are quite two different entities. Like Canada contributes to NATO and NATO is contributing actively to collective defense. For example, we have troops in Latvia. Canada leads a multinational brigade in Latvia to help protect the Baltic states against the threats from Russia. And that is an important contribution to collective defense. I understand your reservation around NATO being mostly EU and European while we're North American. One, Canada has quite been the leader in rejecting NATO from the North American Arctic. And I think that we need to rethink that position. And we've been rethinking it for the better part of a decade. Because think about it, the Arctic is at the pole and the Earth is round. So tensions in the European high north is going to impact Canada, whether we like it or not. We're neighbors to Russia, even though we don't look at it on the map with the current projection that we look at our maps of the globe. But we're close to Russia, and Russia has been militarily investing in the Pacific part of its Arctic. And Sweden, Finland, and Norway have been quite vocal about protecting the Arctic, and they view Canada as part of it. Obviously, our proximity to the United States and our relationship to the United States makes it that we're pulled in strategically, and the existence of NORAD is an active proof of that. That doesn't mean that we cannot be more autonomous strategically from the United States, even if we keep that binational command of NORAD, because the North American Arctic is massive and there's connection through land, and that needs to be monitored. I'm not saying that we need to completely cut off from the United States, and we will never get to the same level of defense spending as the United States, nor do I think we need to. But the goal is for Canada and the 30 other NATO members to be a little bit stronger so that if the United States decides to pull out from NATO or decides to do something that is against the interests of NATO, we don't find ourselves scrambling militarily and politically to ensure our national defense and the defense of the Euro-Atlantic, which is a massive geographical area to cover defense-wise.
No, that's a great point. Hey, Charlotte, and you're probably the best one too, because I know the listeners probably will ask the next question. NORAD, right? Mm-hmm. And the condition of NORAD. Can you give us a 2 minute on, because I think you mentioned it. I think that's an important one to talk about.
I thought it was just a movie set at this point.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that it was active.
It kind of feels like that, but NORAD has been in place since 1953. It's what we call a binational command. So contrary to NATO, that is an alliance, NORAD actually shares personnel and capabilities from both the United States and Canada to protect the North American aerospace, which extends into the Canadian Arctic. So that, for example, remember the balloon incident back in 2023? NORAD got involved in that to shoot down that balloon that was suspected to be spying on the North American airspace. During 9/11, NORAD defense was triggered, and actually it's Canada that took command of NORAD to coordinate a military response to potentially more planes coming into the United States and strike it down. So it is very much a military command to the same way that our Royal Canadian Air Force is a military command that can actively and directly act and lead operations in the North American airspace to defend both Canada and the United States when necessary. And actually, for the Chinese spy balloon incident, it was an American jet that struck it down over the Yukon because it just happened to be the closer fighter jet available. And it was a decision made by both President Biden at the time and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to act on this. So there needs to be agreement from both commander-in-chiefs for something to be happened at the NORAD level. So it's not an alliance. It's a command that is purely military. But obviously, the current chain of command where our Prime Minister and the President sit at the top is still involved because that's how chain of commands function.
Right.
What kind of condition is it in at this point? It looks like they're allocating $40 billion directly to NORAD.
Yeah, it's NORAD modernization. So our radars and capabilities are very old. It is mostly sharing capabilities. There would need to be a conversation about negotiating an out if we want NORAD to end. And there's no requirements of shared defense spending or anything of the sort for NORAD to continue. Right now, there's an agreement in place. Honestly, right now, we're in a good position where President Trump doesn't want to review it. And NORAD has been beneficial to Canada in the past and to the United States. But right now, no condition attributed in terms of defense spending, just a certain level of burden sharing that is negotiated from time to time, as it has been in 2022 with the agreement around NORAD modernization.
You know, one of the questions I had that kind of butts up against this conversation is that, you know, I've always envisioned Canada as a peacekeeping force, Charlotte, to be honest with you, that Canada goes around the world and, you know, we're part of the UN peacekeeping forces, and mm-hmm. Canada's out there bringing, you know, after war solutions and that sort of thing. And I wonder if maybe that's just a perception that I have wrong. And will this update and sort of budgetary commitment change that? Will we become more of a military force rather than a peacekeeping and aid force? And am I wrong entirely about that assumption?
Can I layer one piece? Please. And then this is for Charlotte, right? Which is kind of my NORAD thing too. what, you know, this is interesting, and, you know, and having lived both in the U.S. and Canada, so I've seen it from both sides. The U.S. has a very aggressive position with respect to nuclear, right? We don't, right? And we've kind of kept that off the table. And I guess it really becomes, you know, this spending that we're talking about doing, a kind of what is the level we're talking about, you know, because as we go into this, I think it becomes, you know, talking about what are we prepared to do and what are we prepared to produce and what are we prepared to carry as a military? And I think that's a, framework that needs to be.
Yeah. How are we now positioned with our military?
What's our position on nuclear?
Yeah.
You know, we're a high uranium country, you know, quite frankly, nuclear, we nuclear power wise, we're well advanced from the U.S. So we are way ahead of the U.S. on nuclear power.
By the way, today's show is brought to you by rich, rich Canadian uranium.
Thank you. but yet, you know, the U.S. now, you know, the U.S. I think has in their stockpile about 7,000 nuclear warheads.
Right.
Right. So they've determined that that's a position they're willing to take. And we have zero.
Yeah.
Right. So I guess, and Char, jump in anytime. But my thinking is, I think you have to determine the framework. Like if whoever's, you know, doing, I'm sure they're talking about it, but you know, you can go out and recruit 1 million people. You can go out and you can build tanks. You can build, but you know, at the end of the day, you know, when you're talking about the Arctic, we are, 1 million, you know, square, miles, right? We're the second biggest country in the world behind Russia, which it's on our border on top of the Arctic, right? You know, our position on this has to be, how do we manage such a big landmass with such few people, right? And that becomes the issue. You know, I looked at, even if we wanted to get into this game with people, we only have, I think the experts are saying, we only have at most in the whole country right now, 8 million eligible people to be in the military. So if we decided tomorrow we wanted everyone, we could get in Canada to be in the military, we could get 8 million people. You know, the U.S. could get 73 million, right?
Yeah.
So, and I'm sure the other countries. So, you know, it becomes an issue of, you know, creating the framework. And from that framework, I think you have to say, what are we willing to do militarily to protect ourselves? And then working backwards and then forming it. And that's...
Do you think that's... Is that the strategy? Yeah. Is that how they go about this process?
Yes. So I'm going to start from the top with your question about peacekeeping. Canada has not been involved in peacekeeping missions per se in such a long time. Like right now we have 5 military staff deployed to UN missions. It's been like longer than my lifetime that Canada has not been very much involved in peacekeeping missions. So that is very much still a remaining perception. I don't think it is wrong to still have that perception because it was such a big part of the Canadian perception of itself on the international stage, thanks to our former Prime Minister Pearson. But that remains to be an issue, and we haven't been really involved in peacekeeping missions for a long, long time. And there needs to be a conversation about this, like, will Canada go back to this? But the militarization of Canada's defense and foreign policy has been happening for decades and has accelerated around Afghanistan. And so that is an important point to make. But I think that there's something to the fact that a lot of Canadians still perceive themselves as peacekeepers, but our government doesn't. Where does that lead us? And will that gap create problems down the line, especially as we're going to talk about a little bit about recruitment to get to your point a little bit later, Paul? That is an important thing to say. In terms of nuclear, Canada is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And so to obtain nuclear warheads, Canada would need to violate that treaty or withdraw from it, which has massive international law implications because you are held to a certain standard of respecting international law, even when you're not a signatory to a treaty. And this is where the tensions around Iran, possibly acquiring nuclear heads or manufacturing nuclear warheads is an issue. So that would be a massive breach of international law if Canada were to do that. There are no expectations for Canada to acquire nuclear warheads. Actually, we're not even acquiring nuclear submarines for that simple reason, that we don't want to touch the issue of nuclear in defense, except for certain energy provision like Ontario and its fantastic nuclear energy capabilities. Then, in terms of spending, military vision, strategy, we have a defense policy called our North Strong and Free that came out in April of 2024 that is actually positioning Canada towards the defense of the continent and the defense of its Arctic as the main focus of our activities, and then the Euro-Atlantic Alliance as the second part, and then the Indo-Pacific as the third part. So we know what we want to do, and that is protecting the North American continent, protect our Arctic with the naval, air and land capabilities necessary to do so. This is where we are focusing our modernization efforts, whether it's Army modernization, Navy modernization, Air Force modernization, and even NORAD modernization. So there is a vision there, and that is deterrence, which is a very elusive concept. So basically, deterrence is the idea that you need to have certain military capabilities to prevent an attack on yourself. And so fighter jets come into that, anti-submarines and anti-submarine warfare come into that. But there's also the acquisition of radars and activities to monitor activities that also contribute to deterrence. And the problem with deterrence is that you need to prove that it's working through a negative. Right? Deterrence is working because we do not have war on our territory. But there's also the issue that now we have what we call gray zone activities, where we see cyber attacks, foreign interference on the part of India, on the part of China, on the part of Russia, happening on the Canadian territory. But that cannot be responded to via military means because it would be severely escalating something. Then the last piece.
I'm so sorry, Sharon. On that point, just so that I don't lose it, that what we need from, I guess, a defense standpoint or any sort of military standpoint has drastically changed in just the last 5 years, and will change dramatically, I would assume, in the next 5 years, what the requirements would have been from a defense budget. You know, just 15 years ago has changed dramatically. Is that part of this strategy for defense, cyber, satellite? Yeah.
It is. And I gotta say, we cannot look at the current view that Canada is taking in terms of defense without looking at what's happening in Ukraine, right? We thought that Europe was safe from war because it hasn't happened for the better part of 7 years. But now we find Europe at war on its border and at war literally with Ukraine and with the risk daily for that war to escalate to NATO countries. Actually, we're looking at Poland, we're looking at Lithuania and Latvia. So we cannot just talk about a Trump effect. We need to talk about the fact that war is happening in Europe. China is becoming more and more aggressive towards other countries, towards Taiwan and towards allies and ourselves. Remember the two Michaels being kidnapped and imprisoned by the Chinese government and the economic coercion that was taking place. So what I want to say is that we need military capabilities to protect ourselves potentially from that. We need an alliance to support us because we do understand that doing this alone is almost impossible when you're dealing with countries that are, let maybe say, over-investing in defense, prioritizing defense as part of their overall budget. So this is where NATO comes into place. It's almost an assurance that if we go to war as Canada, or if we find ourselves under attack as Canada, we will have support of other countries to help us fight this attack. So this is where an alliance like NATO and a bi-national command like NORAD becomes very useful, so that we don't have to make defense the number one thing that we do on the part of our government.
Right. Well, that, yeah, and it kind of comes full circle, Charlotte. So, I totally agree with you. I'm on board. I'm just trying to balance in my mind, what is the expenditure? So I'm just trying to, as you're talking, I'm thinking, no, I totally agree everything you say. But I know it's not 150 billion. Mm-hmm. I know, because I know we can't do that, right? Like I used to be a CPA by trade, so maybe I'm a little conservative, but I know we last year had a deficit for the country of $62 billion, right? So this is kind of a cost that we're trying to figure out now. How do we place it, and where do we place it? You know, and there's all kinds of rumors and spiraling around about, you know, the number of people in government, the HST, GST, you know, going up, all this stuff. So we finding money to do this. And I know we need to do it. I'm just trying to figure out, what is it, you know, what is the number, you know, because we're at 1.4 or 30 billion right now. And, you know, how do you get that number? And then how do you deploy it, given where you're at right now? And, we haven't even talked about, you know, I don't want to lose the thought too, before we finish today. I want to really go back, because I when you were talking about kind of the culture of in the military, I want to also talk to you a little bit about, you know, what happened over the last couple of years coming out of COVID, because I really would like to understand that, because that was really confusing for a person that's not involved in it, as we were kind of coming out of COVID and all the challenges that were appearing and cracks in the armor on the military side. So from a cultural perspective, so we won't lose that, but let's get back to the financials on it. How do we balance this, and what is the number, and how do we get the, because originally I was feeling pretty good. You know, when we said we're going to 2%, they laid out a plan. It was a pretty good plan. And it was kind of, there were five pillars, I think, to it. And the five pillars, you know, laid out where they were going to put the money. And then all of a sudden we go to the bigger number, the $150 billion number. And to your point earlier, you know, two thirds of it was going toward, or 3.5% of it's going towards core military, and the rest is going towards, well, How do you break that down? You know, like what
infrastructure
is
infrastructure rebuild up against core?
Yeah,
it seemed, when we read the stats, the spending, it sounded to me, sorry, Charlotte, it sounded to me like they were lumping in, they were separating the numbers for one budget or one explanation, and then lumping them together as an explanation of the whole. Is this separate? Because it looks like $150 billion overall.
Annually.
Annually overall.
Overall, yeah.
But part of that was meant to be infrastructure rebuild, and the other part was core. And I'm trying to understand what the difference is.
Okay, so a few things. I share your concern about how we are going to be able to afford it, especially as your auditors and yourself can see our social safety net not being as strong as it used to be. Like, for example, healthcare is in shambles in Canada right now, and we need to pay for that as well. So I do completely share your concerns, and I think that this is a square that Prime Minister Carney definitely needs to circle if we are going to make that commitment. Then for the split between 3.5% and the 1.5%. So 3.5%, self-explanatory, core defense spending, so personnel, capabilities, equipment, all of that good stuff. The infrastructure piece, for example, we need roads to be able to move ammunitions around for vehicles to transport troops from, let's say, Petawawa to Ottawa, so that they can take a plane and deploy. But those will also be infrastructure that everyday Canadians can use. For example, if you live in Ottawa, because it's not just Canadian soldiers that live there, to go to Ottawa, you will be using the same road. So those are infrastructure that will have a defense use, but also useful to everyday Canadians. So this is why they're separated in a way, because they're not directly for defense, but they will have a defense purpose. So we can call them dual use. Same thing with ports. We need ports to send equipment to Latvia, for example. But we also need it for trade exchange, because out of the port of Montreal is where we do a lot of trade. This is where we send commodities. This is where we send energy to other countries. And so there will be a defense use for those facilities, but it's also good for the Canadian economy and for the use of everyday Canadian. So this is why it has been separated. It's a little bit of weird arithmetic, but it's to make sure that spending that is not directly related to defense but would be useful for the execution of defense to be counted in the spending that our government is doing.
Well, I had no idea that that was part of the consideration of the defense budget. You just don't get this kind of explanation when there's a scrum and they're asking Carney, you know, how are you going to spend the money? He's got two or three points to make, but then it leaves us all kind of staggering around going, hold on a second, that doesn't make sense. Because the detail, the nuance of this spending, I think is widely missed by most Canadians. You know, I had no idea that this was part of that defense spending.
Let's layer one piece on. This is a really kind of, I love this topic. You know, my accounting brain is going crazy. So
Paul's on fire right now.
No. And it really does. So, okay. So I'm looking at my fruit right now, trying to figure out what comes from Canada.
Yeah.
Right. So why isn't all my military come from Canada? So now I'm saying to myself, right, Charlotte's speaking, I'm saying, you know, and Charlotte, you know, this is near and dear to my heart, because Mike and I were at Downsview a few weeks ago on another matter, doing another business, the air base, you know, now they're doing the stadium and the concerts, you know, Coldplay and everything happening. And that was the night the last show was going on. So we're over there and I'm reminiscing, cause I had a grandfather, who built planes, and headed up a shift out of Downsview, during the war. Right. So, and you know that we were at that point, we were a military machine, right? You know, you could see down to, you see the hangars and the huge cafeterias, and we walked.
You could see the old signs for de Havilland and these Canadian manufacturing.
What was the size of the office? Remember the office we walked through? It was like a show. It was like a perfect movie set. We walked through an office that probably had 2,000 seats,
yeah,
and an engineering bay that probably had another 500 seats of people. So we walked through and
it was like at a Mad Men era.
Yeah, it was eerie because they had left the furniture from probably, when did they leave there? In the
80s, mid 80s.
In the 80s. Like, yeah. So they left the furniture from the 80s and it was all sitting there, and the people's name tags were on the cubicles. And so, you know, I'm digressing a little bit, but reminiscing, but you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking to myself, you know, as an entrepreneur, I'm thinking, okay, you know, I'm heading to the Arctic, right? I'm going to set up a plant, you know, I'm going to start to build. What do we need to build in the Arctic, right? You know, I'm feeling sorry for the guys in Hamilton right now in the steel zone, right? So why are we not redeploying?
Well, you raise a good point. We're bringing a military budget in that feels pushed on us by NATO and a little bit bullied at our border by Trump, just as he's putting tariffs on the things that we need to buy from him and the elements we need to buy from the United States at this new tariffed rate. So he's basically forcing the tariff sale. Am I wrong?
Yeah, no, it is. But, and that takes us to the, you know, isn't this a great opportunity if we're going to do something in, you know,
build Canadian,
but if in order to get through this period, we need infrastructure projects that are going to, so I love when Charlotte brings up roads. I go nuts about, you know, the my road thing, right? Canada's a road nightmare, right? You know, why we can, having lived, you know, having worked in the United States, Mexico, and done some projects in Europe, why we cannot build roads. I have no idea, right? Why the technology on roads is such a mystery to Canadians. It just boggles my mind. Like, I don't know why we don't and why we can't. So can we get past that? Like, you know, we talk about housing crisis. Some of our housing crisis, believe it or not, it's because we can't build roads.
Yeah,
we can't build infrastructure.
We don't have plans.
It's not because we don't have a place. We're the largest landmass in the world, right? So we definitely have space for people. It's not like we don't have big landmasses that are empty adjacent to the cities, right? Yeah. We just don't have the infrastructure capabilities to build to them. So we decide that it's easier to build up than build out, which we should.
Do you think this will lend to sort of the advancement of other manufacturing made in Canada and our own infrastructure operating better?
Yeah, and this is part of, I think, the overall theme that I'm picking out from talking to you guys is the problem of communication from our government in terms of defense matters to Canadians. So for the past couple of years, even before we actually talked about the 5% of GDP, our government has been looking at developing a defense industrial strategy and actually looking at what we would call domestic sovereign capabilities. That is to say, things that need to be developed in Canada, that needs to be built Canadian with safe supply chains. You must know an example from that, and that's the National Shipbuilding Strategy that started under Prime Minister Harper, but continued. And all the ships that our Royal Canadian Navy are getting right now were built in Canada by either Seaspan, Irving, or Davy. So that is something that we have done in the past, that we have built in the past. The thing is that we need to be very mindful of is the fact that it takes time to rebuild an economy that we lost, or an expertise that we've lost. And so to go to the issue of housing, to go to the issue of infrastructure, Canada will need to build that expertise. And I think that maybe let's not compare ourselves to certain Southern European countries or Central European countries, but let's look at what Finland, Norway, and Sweden, who have a similar climate to us, are doing. Actually, most of Europe is more north than Canada. So, or even the population, where the population of Canada lives. And so what is Norway doing in terms of infrastructure in the north? What is Sweden doing in terms of infrastructure in the north? And try to learn lessons and develop our own lessons and develop our own expertise. And that needs to come into play. If we want to do the defense spending that we want to do, we need to have a whole of government, a whole of society, and a whole of economy mindset if we want to get to where we want to be and be protected from tariffs and economic coercion that the United States is not the only country doing that to Canada, but we need to protect ourselves. And I think that poor communication from the government of Canada in terms of explaining what we are doing in defense and how we are implementing all of this, but also a problem of overall strategy, including at the economic level, to explain how we're going to spend that money and how we're going to make that money back in a sort of way, is really needed if we want to have the support of Canadians for this kind of defense spending. And I do think that that support is necessary because we're in a democracy. Just for that simple fact, I think it's important to have better communication.
Charlotte, sorry, we won't keep you forever. This has been a fascinating conversation. I really hope that, we can get you back, because as we try to do these deep dives, we learn, and that's the mission. I mean, we make assumptions, we have perceptions, we have purviews, but we don't get the entire story. We don't get this interaction. One of the things that I read, and I took a look at all of the opposition comments, and now that we've had a little bit more information, I could scratch out six or seven of them here as fairly uninformed opinions. But one of the ones that stuck out. And I think this is an ongoing sort of feeling among Canadians that are critics of how we spend money. James Bazan, a conservative MP, came out with this on Twitter. He said, when will Mark Carney show Canadians a plan for how his promised new defense spending will actually increase our capability to defend? And this conversation answers a lot of those questions because it's not top level things that you see at 30,000 feet. It's in the minutiae. It's in the details that we find out what all of this really means. And I have to agree with Charlotte. I think our government does not do an amazing job of explaining this to us in terms that are easy for us to digest. This is how it helps. This is what it means. This is what these spending dollars actually mean. This is how NATO actually works. This has been an important conversation.
Yeah, it has. It really has. And you know, I agree, Mike. I think we'd like Charlotte next time to sit down. I want to try to jump into the culture of the military. Mm-hmm. So I think that's going to take us probably a good hour to do on just on its own.
And that's really, that's your specialty in a lot of ways. By the way, Charlotte, please plug your book right now while we have a moment. We're thinking of it.
Oh, absolutely. So thank you for the opportunity. So about 3 years ago, I published The Ones We Let Down, Gender Integration and Toxic Culture of Leadership in the Canadian Armed Forces. So I examine the integration of women after 89 when we opened combat roles to them and try to understand why we failed to properly integrate women and why some of the issues such as the 2021 sexual misconduct crisis are remaining. And my argument is that during the 1990s, there was a very toxic leadership climate within the Canadian Armed Forces. And I argued that gender integration shouldn't be seen in isolation from the rest of the culture and the structure of the Canadian military. And toxicity is a good concept to view what was happening at the time and is actually still a useful concept to view some of the problems remaining, as we have seen a couple of weeks ago with the Blue Hackle Mafia and extremism in the ranks.
Well, I will I'll encourage people to take a deeper dive through that as well, because that's, I think, where our next conversation with Charlotte goes.
Yeah.
I think that understanding more about our military will get more Canadians involved in supporting our military, understanding and maybe even joining our forces as human in the human capacity. And hopefully that's what this accomplishes.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I was lucky enough, Charlotte, and next podcast, but I was lucky enough to live in Annapolis, Maryland, right beside the Naval Academy in the U.S. And I loved the military and defense and spent a lot of time down there with the officers and the families that were there. And, you know, learned a lot about the U.S. military and, you know, coming back, born here, I want to know more. I really do. I want to understand.
We don't have that sense of pride and understanding of our military divisions and
you know, where do our officers go? What do they get trained to do? What do they do when they come out of the military? You know, I knew all that down there. I know, like, I knew, where the officers went, what they were specialized in, all those things, you know, and that was great because I'd sit and talk to them on the street. They'd tell me, old cobblestone town, they'd sit and have a drink and explain, you know, where they were shipping out to, why they were shipping out, and everyone in the community understood it. So,
right.
And that's
where you get support and understanding. And then even after the fact, these people come back from their situations and their service, we need to support them. And you get more, I would imagine, support in the community when they understand what you went there for in the first place.
Exactly. Exactly.
Charlotte, this has been amazing. By the way, Charlotte Duvall-Lantoine, VP Ottawa Operations, Canadian Global Affairs Institute. You have been a wealth of knowledge.
It was very much a pleasure. And I really appreciate your curiosity about defense. And I'm looking forward to our next conversation.